Well, prepared for us this episode, inspired by, I think, what we can look forward to as several more years of that hot antitrust action that the three of us enjoyed so much in the early 2000s that sustained us and probably lots of print media back then. Brandon and I collaborated on my top 10 tech and productivity wish list for regulators in the DOG and EU. Now, we also brought in our friend, ChatGPT. To help formulate some of my my original draft, and I think so. We've got a lot going on here. One, you know, I think the Department of Justice. It's the Department of Justice, right? Not the other one. They're the ones
DOJ,
doing antitrust.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So I think the DOJ and the EU Commission are really they must have gotten a hand their hands on Lean Startup and maybe some design books, because they're just going like full force into product management and product design, adding features here, removing things, defining markets. I think, and you know, now I listen to a lot of the you know, the tech people out there, and they of course don't like, well, let's be honest, no one likes telling them what to do. And so you can take that truism, that generalization truism, if that's a phrase, and apply that to tech. Do tech people like telling them what to do? No, sir. No. They do not. Does my four-year-old like her telling, like people telling her what to do? No, no. Sir. She no. does not. No one likes it. So that said, let's think about, we have USB-Cs to charge my phone.
That should have been enough, right? Right. That was the first, that was their first attempt to, like, you know, still the waters. They were like, we'll do USB-C. Can you just leave us alone?
But do you think, in the EU, they were like, after they got the win in their annual review, they're like, okay, you got USB-C, but like, what are you going to do next year? Like,
you think there was blood in the water?
They're like, this isn't enough. Give us more.
They were at the end of their release train. They're doing the retrospective. They're like, Pierre, what are we going to put up on and the green?
I think it was Hans.
And Hans was like, USB-C for my iPhone. I think Hans turned Nordic. I'm not really sure what happened there. And then so they put USB-C up on there, and then they were like, what are things that went bad? And there was some chatting, nothing in that column. And then they were like, what are we going to work on next time? And there's a long fucking list there. Like, I think we're going to get, you know, I think what went wrong is they were like, ooh, we didn't write the Netherlands. They didn't write that law right about allowing people to sell outside of the app store. We got kind of fucked on that. And that didn't. And that was the Dutch person talking, because the rest of them, they wouldn't say fucked. But the Dutch people were just like, that was like some fucking cancer sprayed on us from Apple. There.
Apparently they learned their English from Australians.
That's right. And so they got to fix that one. So I think we're probably going to look forward to the EU being like, don't fuck with the EU. And just kind of like sort out whatever it's going to be there. So that'll be nice. So I think we are going to get some benefits from product managing. Now, I'm not really sure about the country that brought you the LeBaron and the Ford Caprice. If they're going to do great at product design, I don't think Iacocca's around anymore. We'll see. I think Apple vacuumed up all the design people. So it might be rough over on that side of the Atlantic, but we'll see how we can product manage over here. Nonetheless, I was thinking, while the DOG and the EU is at product management and, you know, features, I have a list of 10 that I think they should get to. Because if they're just doing product management and design, let's do it, right? So I'm going to read through, as done by ChatGPT, my top 10 tech and productivity wish list for regulators. Number one, these are not really that funny, but I'm going to read them anyways. Number one, clickable links and Instagram captions. Make it easier to direct followers to content.
DOJ, I don't know, going hard.
I don't know. And I feel like this could be an easy win. Now, of course, Meta's going to draw this out over a year, maybe three. But the is it the prosecution or is the state defending? Probably defending. If you get to write who's defending, if you're doing antitrust, the state is probably a defendant because they're being
No, they're prosecuting Apple, and in this case, they're prosecuting Facebook, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
you'd want to force
ChatGPT going hard with, you know, shooting a nearby company.
So I think what's going to happen there is is it a brief? They're basically gonna, it's gonna be like, they're gonna submit whatever the W3C HTML standard is, as evidence. Mm-hmm. They might even have a, is it amicus brief? Amicus brief from Tim Berners-Lee, who's like, it's fucking hypertext. That's the point of this goddamn thing. And then they're going to have
being that professional witness.
And then they're going to have, here's how you do a link. There'd be less than sign, A space href equals, quotes are optional, URL. Oh, they are? I'm assuming browsers make it. Maybe, hopefully the intern put that in and one of the fancy lawyers is going to be like, I don't think so. This is the law. You can't fuck around like that. Like, and so like they'll have double quotes and then you greater than sign, text, and then I won't read it all. You close it. And they'll be like, Your Honor, I rest my case. So, okay, number two, unified social media. Allow seamless posting across platforms, ideally leveraging Twitter's existing reach, which ChatGPT rewrote because I was like, ideally, you know, I would use Twitter where I have over 11,000 followers, unlike Threads where I've got
progress
two.
Progress was made this week, though. Our friends over at Threads, they did enable the Federation. So it started. Federation. Yeah. Mastodon and Threads are now sort of...
I think what you got to do, the DOJ, they're going to have a meeting in a parking garage with like the DOD, and they're going to be like, look it, you go tell that guy to make this Twitter thing work, or we're canceling all that space shit that you're paying for.
Oh, I like it.
No more government Starlink buying. And I think there might be something wrong with their airwaves. I'm not quite sure. Our FCC buddies are over here. All they got to do is federate the shit and open the APIs.
No more rockets. Rockets for Federation. I like it.
Yeah. Okay. Number three, native ChatGPT downloads. Eliminate the need for external plugins to download chat sessions.
Wow.
That one seems pretty straightforward because there's already a Chrome plugin to do it. So obviously it's possible. All right. Number four, universal link insertion shortcut. Standardized link insertion across apps. Command K for everyone. Now, this is also going to be known when it gets rewritten. This is going to be known as the Slack case because Slack is the only app where you highlight some text and you want to put a link in, that Command K doesn't actually do anything. You can tell Matt Ray is shocked to hear that. Oh yeah, just try it. Try to link something in Slack and do Command K. All right, number five. This is my special one. Apple Notes customization integration. Enable background customizations and merge with Freeform to challenge GoodNotes dominance. I'm not really sure if that's antitrust. It might be the reverse of antitrust. This might be something that the EU and the DOJ can sort of like compromise or gift Apple. They could be like, I know you've been holding back from making Apple Notes the best note-taking application in existence. You weren't writing to native Markdown files or even using, Markdown bundle files so you can have images. You weren't allowing intermixing text in the pencil drawing thing. Or as everyone knows, this is why Cote can't use his excellent scanned in vintage graph paper as a background. But I'll tell you what. If you stop with this fucking around with the App Store, you can do it. So maybe that's on the table for them to add in there. Number six, universal free busy calendar.
Oh, gosh. Oh.
No, we're going to chat GPT.
The EU is going and telling Apple to start Sherlocking more companies. That's
why
what I'm
hearing.
Why can't
this be number one? I feel like this should be number one, but go on, Kota.
Yes, this is one we all need.
There might be a counter proposal that CERN is going to have to pay the bill for a centralized calendar booking system that might tie this whole system up for a while. It might have to be located to Ireland for tax purposes. I'm not sure. Maybe it's in Luxembourg or Switzerland.
They're in
or
the Liechtenstein. EU. Oh no.
Well, you know, so you don't have to worry about sovereignty or something. This might be a business for the Bahamas. Although recently they extradited that guy who was trying to hide out in the Bahamas. So I'm a little stressed out about.
Give it to Switzerland. They can hold our calendars.
And who is better at keeping time and doing things in a timely fashion than the Swiss?
Exactly.
We would all trust our calendar there. All right. Number seven, standard Markdown export. Ensure all major word processors export in a common Markdown format.
Oh, that's the dream.
I think that's now importing. That might be for like a 2026 goal, maybe even the 2030s.
I just love the fact that the EU just kind of, you know, pulls up and they're like, we're going to fix things the way Apple works in the market by updating their products.
This is my whole point is what's going on here. Some hardcore product management.
Okay.
Number eight, granular screen time controls unified across all devices. Now, this is for the kids. So how can you argue against it?
Or the children.
Oh, yes. The children. Someone think of the children.
You know, because I don't know if, well, I do know. Y'all probably use Apple screen time, which, like so many Apple products, is just barely not good enough to drive you insane, right? Like, it's just like, if only there could be, like, and I know this is a hard challenge. All of us and many of the listeners have worked on this challenge, but you want to have, like, you know, custom groups and subgroups and, like, sure, I don't want them to use their phone between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., except for these five edge cases. And in those five edge cases, I don't want these things to happen. And, you know, this is, you could get really lost in all sorts of, like, RBAC madness and things like that. But, like, I feel like we figured it out for enterprise identity management. We could do it here. Maybe number nine, regulate car insurance fees. Put a stop to excessive and unfair insurance charges by rental companies. Now, what our friend ChatGPT lost about this is, I said, I realize this has nothing to do with technology. But my understanding is every company is a software company now, so I think it fits in here. And you can start doing that.
This is just morphing into Cote's airing of grievances.
Number 10, we have to force Google to bring back Google Reader.
I am here for the DOJ, just shooting companies willy-nilly.
I like it, Cote. I think this is an excellent list, Cote, and I appreciate ChatGPT helping us out on it. And I do think we can now go to the negotiating table. Maybe with Google, it's like, listen, we're gonna let that default behavior go down with Apple, but you're gonna have to give us Google Reader. Like, we just trade billions of dollars for small things. Like, yep, that's what we're putting on the table. Are there any?
They're like, wait. If we fund a pizza team, we can continue to interfere with businesses across the world. Like, yes, that's all we want.
I love it.
Yeah, it'll be like, I don't know about this whole paying Apple $30-40 billion a year to be the default search thing. But you know what? I could forget about it if I could just read my RSS feed.
I could look past it. I could look past some of those questions, you know, so it's good. Well, it's good. Well, I think for sure this should go right to the EEO and the DOJ, and they should immediately start having teams look at this. And I expect, you know, probably no less than five new cases to be spawned from your list here. It's going to be.
Oh, and I feel like we've got a great team here in the Software Defined Talk antitrust advisory division, because we've got a very international team, America based. We've done lots of software. We've got Australia based, which I think they're part of the, is it the 5-7 Eyes? However many eyes we got.
Part of the five eyes, and the contributor to the Dutch cursing, apparently.
So the Australians could be like, guess what? Ain't no fucking space rockets here either, mate. Unless we get some opening up of Twitter. And then you know, I think when it comes to the EU, I pay plenty of taxes that I think I could be qualified to help out. So speaking of paying plenty of taxes to help out, I think there's another slide down. I don't know. I think Matt Assay is changing my mind around a little bit, but I think we should explore that. But there's another slide down the basically some of the content and work for Adam Jacobs' next Twitter thread. If he hasn't had one already, maybe a good talk he can give at one of these Linux Foundation OSS conferences. And that is, I don't know if it's Redis, whatever it is, Reddit, read it. I don't know either. But they've changed their license around. Now, in true me fashion, I didn't actually go read the license or the details, but I read people talking about it. And I think they did the whole let's stop these public cloud companies from not giving us any money relicense thing. But Matt Ray, you are an expert on open source. what's going on here?
All right. So your history lesson in a nutshell. Redis is a key value caching database. So it's meant to be like your speedy front end behind a bigger database. And it's been super popular since it was introduced. The original author, I'm not sure his nationality, but he went by Antires on, GitHub and the like, licensed it with the BSD license, which is the most business friendly. It lets you pretty much take the code and do whatever you want with it. And he said, you know, recently that he did this because he wanted people to have commercial options with Ritas, full stop. So Ritas became quite popular, and companies and contributors all around the world started contributing, using it, very popular. And this company called Garantia Labs, Garantia Data, showed up and, you know, changed their name to Ritas, Ritas Labs, I think, or Ritas Data. And we're told, like, hey, cease and desist. You know, it's 2016. You can't just use the name of the product. And they're like, okay, we'll do that. And then they hired Antires. And then he said, all right, you could do that. And so they changed their name. And he sold his property, you know, all of his Ritas intellectual IP to them. And they changed the name of the company to Ritas. They were apparently not the main contributor to the product at this point. And many similar or many Ritas-based cloud alternatives had launched. You know, AWS has one, GCP has one, Azure has one. Azure's is a partnership with Ritas, the company. That's important here in a second. And so he peaced out. He's like, I'm done with Ritas. See y'all later. And left the company. Ritas continued along merrily on its way for a few more years. And then Ritas, the company that was not the primary contributor to the product at this point, has decided, hey, we're tired of everyone else trying to make money with this. We're going to relicense it to the business source license and close things off. And that's where we are today, or that's where we were like a week ago. And then all the other folks who apparently had been doing the majority of the heavy lifting at this point were like, no, no, no. We want to keep working on that code base. We're going to call it. And then they sat and I made my prediction. Oh, in 3 months, whatever they call it, is going to be hosted by the Linux Foundation. Well, it was 3 days. And so the Valky project has been launched. It's a fork of the original Ritas code base. Most of the core most of the core team are already working on it. And they work for places like, you know, AWS and Google and the like. So this thing is probably going to succeed immediately, because, you know, it's got all the engineering and it's backed by all the big cloud providers. And the only company that like didn't weigh that is still working with Ritas, the company, is Microsoft. And I guess it's because they had a licensing agreement with Ritas already, but they joined the Valky announcement. So that can't be forever. It would be my assumption.
Well, you know, I forget the exact date, but I feel like this is a story as old as 2022. This sort of repeats itself over and over again. But so there's all the engineering isn't at the Ritas
company? No. Apparently most of it had already gone, you know, other places, had always been other, or, you know, ever since Antares wrote it, it became a very popular project, and, you know, just people were using it, and, you know, Ritas is and was embedded in a lot of stuff. And so it was a very healthy open source project, at least externally. You know, that's what it looked like to folks like me. Mm.
So I think, though, I guess as we've been through so many of these stories like so many times now, and I feel like I've kind of just embraced the philosophy, like the fork here is the feature, not a bug. It's like, it's kind of like the system is just working as designed, right? It's like, well, you know, the reason you keep it open source is that if someone decides to change license, you can easily fork it. Yeah. In this case, you have a very healthy community with very deep pocketed maintainers, right? They all work for very large companies. These large companies
the deepest of pockets.
Very large incentives to keep it going. And so it just seems like, I don't know what Ritas will get out of this. It seems like I'm starting to feel like, you know, relicensing is the path to private equity. You know, it's sort of like, well, you just do that. That's kind of sort of your last hope. And then what you do end up with is like some people just won't change because it's hard or whatever, right? So you can just position yourself like, I have this captive set of customers that are going to pay maintenance, and that value stream will look good to private equity down the road. But it doesn't seem like anybody, none of these companies, it's like, oh, it's never like relicensing like opened up this massive opportunity and we made lots more money. So it's sort of like, I don't know. I guess I don't want to become like, it's almost like, numb to it, but it's just like, yeah, well, this is why you make it open source and this is why you can fork it. And if you don't, and if the project isn't big enough and can't fork, then you're probably like, well, it just wasn't that big. It probably needs to live in a proprietary world anyway. In this case, it seems like, yeah, it'll like Valkey will go on to be, maybe this will be the quickest one ever to go from kind of like,
oh yeah,
project of like, kind of like it took a while to get going to actually overtaking the original open source project. Like, you can almost feel like a year from now, I wonder if it feels like Valkey will be like way ahead of Redis.
Yeah, Redis was one of those kind of, I mean, not hidden, but it wasn't like, you know, tip of your tongue. Oh, you know, it's, you know, everywhere, but it's everywhere. And, you know, it had a huge user base and developer base outside of Redis, the company. And so, you know, you got to think though, that these companies making this license change, they're probably talking to each other. You know, they probably went and said, you know, went to, you know, Mongo and
Elasticsearch,
you know,
right?
Elasticsearch and everybody who's made this change and said, you know, did it work? Did it work? Why did you do it? Because probably someone at, you know, this would be my take, is someone's looking at a spreadsheet and they see a declining number. They're like, huh, Redis is more popular than ever and our market share continues to drop. And they're like, well, what can we do to stop? And so maybe, you know, maybe there's an initial spike in usage or you know, customer base as they do this, but long term they can't hold on to it. But maybe long term they were losing it anyway. So you know, I know we both listened to the Cloudcast discussion of VMware or Broadcom's actions with VMware's user base, right? Jack up the prices and hold on and get your money back. Maybe that's what this is. You know, maybe this is.
But I think if you think about it from like, if you just kind of put this aside, like, hey, I'm not judging good or bad. It's just sort of like, I do think if, and also you kind of think like everybody's smart, like you're kind of outlining and comes to the table trying to make a quote unquote rational decision. Like, I think it does make sense. Like I was saying before, it was sort of like, let's just lock in the people we can get, right? The people that are going to pay us no matter what, because they just can't get off it for whatever reason. Right. And that's sort of like, you know, if you will, that's like the biggest upside they could get, because there is no more upside, right? You know, and I guess it's like the company's been around something like 15 years, right? Or the project and the company, like all together. So it's like you're kind of seeing, it's just like, yeah, like this isn't going to be a $1 billion company or whatever. You know, it's not going to go on forever. So it's sort of like lock in what you can get, right? You know, take this maintenance stream. And just like, that's all you could do, because otherwise they're just staring, they're sitting there, they're staring at it and be like, well, we're just going to continue to lose money. Right. And they're probably going to happen either way. So it's like, but I think what have to almost happen simultaneously with this would be like, they probably have to start reducing headcount and like getting out of a growth mode company and sort of be like, hey, we can only kind of capture what we're going to capture. Now, probably on the slides that they created, they were like, we're going to do this and we're going to grow X amount, but we all know that's not going to happen. So it's like, you know, you can get to the private equity model like now, or we can do it in 3 years. Like, which way do you want to go? Right. And it's
exactly.
Like the end, like we know the end of this, right? Cause wasn't it like Hashi, what were we talking about last week? It's like Hashi sort of like shopping itself around to be sold. Right. And it's again, like those aren't like, when you're shopping yourself around, you're never being a position of strength, right? They always say like, you know, great companies are bought, not sold, right? You know, it's like someone just shows up with a great company with so much money they can't say no. When you're shopping, you're in a weakness position. And I think, you know, that's probably what happened here at Redis. It's like, well, there's nothing else they can do. And so it is what it is. So I don't even judge them for it. I'm just like, okay, you've done what you can do here. We all know what's going to happen. Let's just move on.
So that's great. You brought up Mongo and Elastic, because I was wondering like, what's the history of these license changes, right? And are those companies fine?
Yeah, I mean, I think Elastic is. Yeah, I think Mongo and Elastic both
public,
are.
Right. I don't know what Elastic is public, if I remember. And let's see. And then, you know, I realize it's maybe, well, maybe I don't realize this, but like there's similar things to look at this. I guess in my mind, the question is I'm not going to phrase this in the statistical or whatever right way, but like, how successful is this strategy? And, you know, one example is, again, I don't know how it exactly maps, but, you know, Docker screwed around with their licensing or whatever. They were sort of, at some point it was free. And then they were like, how about you pay us? as I remember for their desktop.
So. Apparently, they were taken over by Mario. How about you pay us? Oh,
and so like I think that worked out for them, right? Like they severely messed around with the community dynamics of.
Right, but they really changed their whole product set, right? I mean, they kind of went, you know,
that's what, true.
The original Docker and the orchestration they got rid of, and they did it all in developer.
So maybe to your point, they went through like you know the the private equity CrossFit program, and they kind of got their shit together,
yeah,
and they came out the other end, and they're like you know. Cool divorcee or whatever, and that sorted things out.
Well, they diversified, right? I mean, I think I think the problem the Redis company might have is they don't have a lot of other stuff. You know, so when about you know Mongo and Elastic, I feel like those are a little more business crucial databases, so they have a more stickiness. Redis is a caching layer, and you know it's not a complex API. It's a simple thing, you know, relatively simple thing to replace, I think.
Yeah, and that's an excellent point as well. That it's not complicated enough.
Yeah.
Now dare I say it? It doesn't have excellence lock in. Like the lock in of just like I want to keep using it. Now, as another example. I think this was last year, and maybe to my point, maybe it was the year before, but then Red Hat also messed around with their, I think theirs was a little more clever. It wasn't necessarily licensing, but the outcome, as we say in the business world, I think was kind of the same motivations of like, we would like people to stop taking advantage of what we are providing for free. And we'd prefer to not have that happen. And so like, I'm no Linux distro expert, but they seem to be doing fine.
IBM stock has plateaued in a or what do you call it when it's plateauing going down? I mean stabilized.
Yeah. There you go.
Yes.
But I do think you know, all these open sourcing, I guess the lesson, I think the broad lesson you can take from this, and you know, I've both experienced it firsthand and now watching it over and over, is like, you know, ultimately, if you think of open source and the idea of like from a more purely business side, it's sort of like the leads provided from the open source community consistently do not convert at a high enough level such that the company that's really behind the open source wants to continue to fund it, right? Because if you think of it, it was just a marketing campaign. If you're like, sure, there's a bunch of people using it for free, but we have every quarter, we have a certain amount of people converting at this rate, and it's fine. As long as they keep converting, it's a great business tool to get new customers. But I think we consistently see that does not happen. And I think that's kind of leads to like this cycle that sort of like is outlined. It's like people do it at the very beginning to gain adoption for a product. And I think they mistake like open source for the free. People like the free to they raise awareness. And I think there's always this belief that eventually those are going to convert to sales, and they really don't, right? So it's almost like the very beginning of these projects. If you're open source and you're using it as lead gen, I think there are lots of evidence that like these leads will not convert. So you can either like deal with that at the beginning of your project and be like, hey, we need to think about this before we make it open source, or you can deal with it like, you know, at the middle or end of the life cycle when you start to change these licenses and create a lot of frustration for people. But I don't know. I think at the end, it's just, you know, same thing with Red Hat. Obviously there was a frustration that CentOS wasn't converting, right? So that was the whole thing there. So I think it's pretty, I mean, we have enough data points where I think you can kind of almost write that in stone. Do not mistake people using your open source project as lead generation going forward. So if you're not doing it, if you're doing it for that, you're probably making a mistake.
Well, maybe to try to cobble together a Frankenstein grand theory here. I think one of the things you both of you are saying that sticks in my mind, or that I think is like, I think the dynamics of open source at a mega company are different than at a startup.
Yeah.
Because kind of based on a little like kind of as you were saying, at a big company, you can have what you would call in retail a loss leader. Or what you could call in our area, like a compliment, or I get the terminology mixed up, but like you could basically, and doing the following is something that I feel like only the most sophisticated tech companies can do. Sophisticated is the wrong word, but you can basically make a business case for funding several millions of dollars on something that has no revenue because you've got revenue elsewhere, right? And yeah. like, man, the CFO who can wrap their head around that, fucking gold star in the software world. That's like amazing.
Right. And I think that's to your point. That's what we're seeing here with AWS, absolutely. Google, and the rest of them. Like, there's clearly a belief that like nobody wins competing in this area. It's sort of like it's much better for all of us to just use
the shared caching. There's no money to be made here. Right. We're making
it's
sure
much better for everyone to just use the same shared caching database, call it whatever you want. Yeah. And I think so you can almost say like by transitioning Redis to this area, it seems like you know the Valkey will be on, you know, firm footing for a long time. Because a lot of people want it. No one wants to compete on it. So this project feels like it's going to be, you know, probably has as good a chance to be around in 10 or 15 years as anything that we're actually in the market. So which is like, in some ways, it's like, I hate to use this word, it's like graduation. Maybe this is like getting your doctorate. You know, it's like the project is like almost, like Linux is at that level, right? Linux right. is so massively distributed and so many people working on it and nobody wants to like, want to just own it at this point that like the industry is good, right? Everyone's like, yeah, just like, let's just all use Linux. So there sort of is this kind of like, if you will, the final pyramid of open source where it's just sort of like so distributed and so many people use it, the project will probably live on through like a nuclear attack, right? Whereas other projects that are much smaller, it's just like, well, if they're not at that level, anything can happen.
So then that, you know, to do the ritualistic summing up, of open source business models, successful or not. You know, it feels like number one, you've always got open core, which is to say, sell something that's not free. That's always cool. But then two, I think there's a couple of other ones. One of them is like get bought by a big company. And like to call that that's a business model. And like it seems like I've never been an executive of an open source company, let alone two or three. So I'm not really sure, but I feel like maybe that isn't in like your HR video that like although it's probably something that you say verbally, right? Like we're going to just be big cash out of it here, friends. But like, you know, I feel like if you're managing the company towards being acquired, and maybe they do this, but like there's a different playbook out there that I never read enough of. And then of course the third is the hardest, which is like try to be an independent company, which I guess, you know, as we mentioned, Elastic managed to IPO and do that.
I think Mongo's probably doing the same.
It can happen. And I guess the variation on the second, which is get bought by a bigger company, is just like last long enough for Progress to buy you. It seems to be, you know, a popular one.
Whew.
That was my transition.
I hear your transition. I'm picking up what you're laying down there, Cote.
Which is now this is a whole other interesting thing, is because we just talked about original project, it forks, but then here I think is this and then if that works out, but here we've got the fork trying to figure out a business model, because you had the MySQL that Oracle has through Sun. And now is it Maria or Myra? I never know how to say it.
I think it's Maria. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then you had all the people who didn't like Oracle go off there and they started this, and it doesn't seem to have been turning out well. So now, Matt Ray, your friends Progress are coming in and helping out.
My friends indeed. So, MariaDB was the company that emerged from the ashes of the Oracle Sun acquisition after Sun had bought MySQL, the company. And, you know, so they started a company to do MySQL and, you know, under an open source license, do some services work, do some development, sell some consulting. I think things were going okay for a while. And it looked like they picked up a lot of debt from, unwise investments, and you know it seems kind of murky, because once you start getting into like talk about stock manipulation stuff, you lose me. But Maria, the company, wasn't as healthy as they looked, and then apparently they were out of money. They were you're going to get delisted. They started going the private equity route, and then Progress Software, the acquirers of Chef, decided that hey, we're good at open source, And we're going to buy this Maria company for a larger bid than what private equity was offering.
I'm just giving you some numbers.
I'm waiting to see how this goes.
MariaDB looks like its market cap is $31 million. Its stock is trading around 45 cents. So obviously this is this is the classic, like, you know, buy low. I think you're definitely like, you feel like there's a more money in the brand and I guess the maintenance than the market cap is actually showing. But this is after, because I can't remember, there's a lot of drama, like, because wasn't it Monty, like, they were involved in all that and stuff. So there's like a lot of acrimony inside.
There's a much longer, bigger story here. But what's currently MariaDB, the company, or Maria Software, whatever they are, I don't even think it has most of the original, like, MySQL people there anymore. So this is this is kind of like the Redis company.
And I mean, you know, it sucks to be in a company like that. So, you know, yes. But I feel like if I hadn't ordered that beef rib at the end of year software defined talk meeting, maybe we could afford this company. It seems like at that, I mean, you know, you got to bump it up for like all your costs and whatever. Let's say if you want to acquire this company, you've got a headspace of like 50 million that you're laying out for, you know, hot tub parties and stuff for the investment bankers and whatever else. But like, I guess that like they wouldn't have, I mean, it's a database, which is a very sticky product. So I guess the idea is there's not enough like long-term customers that you would bank on like a 3 or 5 year, like, you know, 150-200% return on that little bit of money or something. That would even be a terrible investment for this kind of thing. But that's a bummer.
Just round out the numbers here. I guess the offer is a 9.1% premium over their current stock. So basically you're paying a 10% premium. And then, yeah, I think you're, to your point, Cote, I think somebody just sits down and does the math. It's like, well, what's the maintenance stream look like over 5 years? And you plug that, the net present value, into like the spreadsheet, and out pops a number. It's like, okay, well, if, you know, we can pay 50 and we can make back 80 or 100 over this period of time, like, that's a great payback. And probably, you know, the Maria customers, I mean, we kind of say it negatively, but, you know, but it's probably better to have someone at least trying to maintain it than no one, right? Or doing something. So if like you haven't, if you can't get off it, you'd rather have someone doing something for you. So, I mean, I don't know.
Now, that said, I don't want to get you all upset, Matt Ray, but like, what is the progress model for this kind of thing? Like, what's their deal?
Well, contrary to popular opinions, they are not private equity. They are a publicly listed software company that acquires, let's just say, small beloved projects and, you know, takes over and extracts revenue from them to get a return on their investment. So they have a large, wide portfolio of things that you're like vaguely aware of. And then they don't generally continue a lot of new investment in that product, in their acquisition.
So I have to say, like, to be fair, I guess you're right, it's not technically a private equity company, but it's just a classic, like, software holding company that's living mostly off the maintenance, right? I mean, that's kind of the,
pretty much, yeah. You
know, which is not unlike, I mean, there's a lot of companies that kind of do something similar. So
it's like a revenue stream aggregator. And like, tape that stuff together. See what works out. Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens there. I think that's an interesting, like, ongoing tracer of what's been happening. So, you know, also since we opened up with some antitrust news, it looks like proactively Microsoft is separating out Teams from Office. Now, before we get into that, I want to say yet again, I think the Software Defined Talk antitrust consultory group organization, the division, the Brain Trust, is uniquely qualified for this because we've used lots of chat things. And not only that, I am one of the handful of people globally who has used not only Teams and not only Slack, but also Google Chat.
Oh, yeah.
My primary work system. So, yeah, you know,
been there and fled.
I can compare and contrast, mostly contrast between these systems. And give a comment on it. Now, I'm getting used to using Google Chat or Spaces I'm not really even bothering to remember what it's called because I know it'll change after a few months. But I think that one thing that I first didn't like about Google Chat, I'm incorporating into my mind as a, what would you call it? A kind of, I can't think of the word, underappreciated or often overlooked potential member of the default's lifestyle is by default in Google Chat, your chat history is turned off and it disappears in like 48 hours. Now, if you were to be using, let's say your conversations in collaboration with your coworkers as sort of like a core function of how your business operates day to day, year to year, kind of like you do email or just sort of like a collective knowledge of stuff, that might be a bad idea. But if you're aware of this, there's a certain sort of like that ephemeral nature of stuff. It kind of opens up. I don't know. It kind of feels liberating. It feels very default's lifestyle-y. Right? Remember when Snapchat came out and all of us old people were like, I don't understand. It disappears after 2 minutes or whatever. But, you know, look at it now. It's, you know, okay.
So it sounds like this would be a good place to have your channel called, you know, Tax Crimes. And so what I'm hearing is, you know, the Sam, what's his SBT or whatever his name was, wouldn't be in jail if they'd been using Google Chat.
That's right. SBF, if only he had disabled the saving the messages.
Now, and it's kind of boggling because I feel like I'm no lawyer, despite being, you know, one of the three people in the premier global technology antitrust consulting firms to both sides. We've got great walls or whatever. Everything's cool. But I feel like there must be regulations that are kind of like, don't do that. Like, you know,
I think that's one of the things that, if anything I've learned from listening to the A16 podcast is, you know, if it's not explicitly against the law, you should be doing it. And, I think, you know, if it's not written down, you should be taking advantage of those things.
Yeah. Well, like we opened up with, no one likes being told what to do from, you know. From super fancy investors that are like driving the technology to my 4-year-old, they can all agree on that. But you know, my only, you know, I guess it makes sense. Like my reaction, of course, being jokey, was like, who would buy Teams alone? But I think the point is more that not that you would buy Teams itself and then use WordStar or whatever instead of Office, but more that like, by making Teams free, I mean, we talked about with this, the open source thing, by making Teams, everyone's going to buy Office. And then if you make Teams free, it basically just kills out the competitors because you got this thing already. That CFO who just, who couldn't get their gold star for funding an open source project, they get a gold star for like, how about we just use this thing we already have? And so I guess in that way, it's basically saying like, no, you can't do that.
Yeah. I mean, I
just like it.
I've never heard people voluntarily choose Teams. It's always like, well, we've stopped using Slack because Teams is free. Mm-hmm.
But it does feel like the whole thing is just over, right? Like, I don't even know. It's like Teams is already like people that were going to convert to Teams have converted to Teams. So it's like, I don't know, now that they're going to take a, you know, debundle it, it's sort of like, well, I mean, it's just going to be two, instead of being one line item on the invoice, it'll just be two line items that they pay for. Right. And it seems there just won't be any change. So I don't know. So this feels like, you know, you're showing up like well after the fight has happened. You're like, well,
yeah,
it's like there was a big fight here. Maybe we should get involved. It's like, well, I think the winner has been shown.
Yeah. That, you know, the way you're describing it makes me think there's going to be a lot of like eye rolling discussion between like salespeople and procurement people where the salesperson is like, listen, I know you know this, but you cannot say that we have sold you a bundle of Teams in Office. Can you please redline that and correct it? We have sold these as separate things. There's no discounting because you're buying both of them. They're totally separate. And the procurement person's probably like, fuck me. I wanted to leave work early. And there you go. So whatever.
Well, I did want to just before we get off the Google thing, I just want to go back there. I found it. I couldn't remember where it was, but Google was famously in another lawsuit with the U.S. where they the U.S. basically accused them of like having the auto delete on by default and not, you know, and that was sort of again, I think in Google saying it was a feature, not a bug. It was like, oh, well, you know, we just use that. And then go in the U.S. DOJ was saying, well, like, you know, you did this on purpose because now we don't have access to everything. They said, oh, no, that's just how we do it. So
that's how we roll. That's how Snapchat works.
So maybe that's a very great, I mean, I don't know, Cote, there's maybe some, you know, the lawyers are too smart. Like, they didn't ask the lawyers, but they just said, like, oh, we're just, you know, by default, we just have on delete. Like, why wouldn't you do that, right? That kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. I forgot about that, but wow. That's even giving me some pause to wrap my brain around that, because I feel like, to rephrase it, it's like to make a t-shirt out of it, it would say, not illegal, works as designed.
Works as designed.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Huh. It's actually a feature that, yeah, I like that. Well, you know, just as if there's several other things that we went over, if you want to read them. Check them out. You can go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/461. You can also see how to join our Slack channel there, where we've discussed lots of these things. I guess I've been in a particularly snarky mood here, but there is something to celebrate from these people. It's been 20 years of Gmail, which I think, you know, maybe it hasn't affected civilization as much as Google search, but it's up there. Maybe, yeah. Let's say top 30. Top 40? I don't know.
Would you say it's the best?
I mean, obviously, the best product is higher on the list. But.
Best product other than Google search? Like, would it be number GBL, Gmail?
YouTube?
I think.
Is there anything?
Well, yeah, YouTube. That's true. Yeah, yeah.
I know, but that YouTube was like acquired, so I kind of put that in a separate.
Was Gmail from scratch, or was it acquired?
Was built from the ground up.
I think. Yeah. I mean, I think it probably is the best. Maps is pretty hard to beat. I would say it goes search.
That's a good
Maps, Gmail.
Yeah. Maps, right? Is pretty,
That's really changed the way the world operates.
Yeah, Maps was literally, I don't know, that's a really tough call. Like, the day you saw Maps versus the day you got, because the thing when you got with Gmail was like, wow, unlimited storage. I mean, but you were using but you had email before probably. Whereas Maps, there was really nothing.
And
there
was Maps was like, I'm going to stop printing out MapQuest.
For some reason. Yeah, well, there you go.
Was MapQuest before that?
MapQuest was totally before that. I used to have
that
like
shit out all the time.
Exactly. Printouts.
It seems so much worse. Like, as soon as you saw Google Maps, you're like, I'm never using MapQuest
again. Yeah, just like done. Yeah, yeah. Now, and I think the other thing that, I don't know, is this true? The other thing that I think about Gmail is it was this triumph of like nerd interfaces, like where like the whole rest of the world just had to put up with like, I mean, if we're all, this is the point I'm making, we're all used to it now. But like the UI for Gmail over the years has been like just like a few steps in quality above VI. Like it's basically like.
So it's Emacs.
And it's kind of like if you just closed one eye and squinted, you'd be like, oh, look, this is Emacs. And so like the fact that so many people use it and are kind of used to that way of thinking is pretty amazing. But great product. Good job. Keep it up.
Good job.
Hopefully there's more than like five people working on it.
It's so dead now.
It's that is like, in addition to using Google Chat, we went from now I use Gmail instead of whatever it is, Office Outlook, and it's just like, oof, I don't even know why they keep trying. It's like I sort of like I had this Kool-Aid like kind of like, you know, someone like cut a little hole in my throat and put a tube down there and fed me the Office 365 email Kool-Aid, and so I sort of forgot. But you go back to Gmail and it's just so nice. It's good stuff, like slipping into cool, clean sheets at night. Well, speaking of clean, cool sheets, any bureaucracy this episode, Brandon?
Just a little bit. Just wanted to thank Pete. He wrote in, so I sent him some stickers. He's up in Minnesota. If you like a sticker, all you have to do is send your postal address to stickers@softwaredefinedtalk.com. Happy sending you a sticker anywhere in the world.
There's also several events and conferences coming up. I'm just laughing because we usually have such a huge list of them, but they're very specialized now. And I think this shows the kind of focus that we in our community has. Now, this actually was broadcast today, the Tanzu Defined online event earlier today, but there's a replay that you should go watch in LinkedIn and YouTube. I don't know if this is officially sanctioned, but if you go to kote.io/Tanzu, T-A-N-Z-U, it'll forward to the LinkedIn thing. But it's like a, I don't know, it's like an EVC-like presentation that has our general manager going over what we do at Tanzu and kind of like the strategy, the vision, all that stuff. And then there's a Q&A that that I did with her, Purnima, and James Waters. I don't know. I think most of it's, well, all of it is pretty good. But I got to do basically write my own intro and outro and the Q&A stuff. So it's what I was responsibly interested in asking, which is pretty fun. And here's a bonus for people who actually watch. You know, you should tell me what you see on the bottom of my shoes, see what you think of that. Keep an eye out for that.
It's a love and hate.
Little Easter eggs. No, it's not. It's nothing actually fascinating. It's just, you know, something to notice. But yeah, you should check that out. Just go to kote.io/Tanzu, or if you go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/461, you can find a link to it. You can watch it in YouTube or LinkedIn. Also, there's NDC Oslo coming up on June 12th. I'll be speaking there. It's in Oslo. There's DevOps Days Amsterdam. I finally came up with a talk that they accepted after a couple of years. I better go check and see what it is. Oh, I think it's about like, tracking developer productivity. Is that a good idea or a bad idea? There's also DevOps Days Birmingham, August 19th, 21st. This is all in 2024, by the way. And then the Open Source Summit North America in Seattle, April 16th to 18th, where Matt will be speaking. What are you going to be speaking about, Matt Ray?
I'm joining with one of the open cost success stories, a large customer, MuleSoft, a subsidiary of Salesforce. We're going to be talking about how they use open cost to change how they track their costs.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Oh, yeah.
So check those conferences out. Now, that said, Brandon, what do you have to recommend this episode?
Well, I'm going to recommend The Three-Body Problem on Netflix. I think probably most of the people listening to this podcast, you probably either seen it or decided you didn't want to see it. Because I think, Matt, you were the first one to recommend this book several years ago.
And I'm still on the fence about watching it. So,
and I've read, I think there are three books. I've read all three books. They're really good. And I think this is one of these things where it's like, I actually thought it was fun to watch having read the books. So I think it's one of those things where it's like, because there's a lot of detail in the books, but like in a good way. Like there's a lot of like kind of subtlety and stuff like that. And then I enjoyed seeing, because when I originally saw that they were going to make this, I was like, wow, this is going to be a hard kind of series to make, to put it together visually. I think they did a pretty good job. I mean, it's a little bit simpler in a good way. So it's almost like, if you like it, like watch the series, but then you can go read the books and get like a lot more detail on certain things. And I think the future seasons, although they did good with this one, I think the future seasons are going to be even more complicated because it sort of gets like, I don't know, maybe more abstract as the series goes on. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. So I think, so in this case, it's almost like you could, I think if you read the books first, I think you'll probably enjoy the series better. Whereas I think Dune, I think the opposite for me was true with Dune. Like I tried Dune like a million times. I could never really read the book, but then I saw the movie and then I read the book and I enjoyed the book much better. So I don't know what that says about me. And also,
you said
I had seen Dune 2, but I had the chance and I took it to see it in IMAX, in like the real IMAX, you know, like
Story IMAX.
Yeah, the museum IMAX, not the fake IMAX. And I saw it and I was like, wow, it was even better. So I think, Matt, you already said this, but I'll just second it. If you get a chance
to see, I haven't watched it yet. I should go do that.
Okay, well, if you get a chance to see Dune 2, someone else, I think, in the Slack made this point. If you get a chance to see it in the real IMAX, I don't even understand the fake IMAX. I just feel like that's just lying. But like the big IMAX, do it. It was definitely worth it. And it was good cinematography, well worth the additional fee. So check out Three Body Problem and Dune 2 and IMAX if you haven't seen it.
Kim and I watched the first episode of that tonight and seemed great. We'll see. Jack Snacks. That's all I know. How about yourself, Matt Ray? What do you have to recommend?
My recommendation is a little simpler. My recommendation is the Uniball Jetstream series of pens. they are, I think Wirecutter loves them. I've been enjoying them for, I don't know, 8 or 9 years now. And for some bizarre reason, 3 of mine ran out of ink this week, and I have ordered a new batch, and I'm getting them straight from Japan. So that's, you know, that's where you get good pens, apparently.
So one of your kids probably came in and used them all up.
That's probably.
They just taped them together. And
they're good pens.
Don't you have like a particular passion for a specific pen? Like Costco
Oh, that's
pen?
What this is. Yeah.
It's the same one.
I've dropped from the 0.7 millimeter to the 0.5. Oh. When I was in Japan last year, I picked up some of the 0.5s and I'm liking them.
So this is it. This is the official. I don't have.
This is the official pen of both Wirecutter and Software Defined Talk.
Okay.
Well, no. Software Defined Talk likes the 0.5, not the 0.7.
Okay. Whoa, hold on. Because I have in my pocket right now the blurry camera. The Pilot G2 07.
That's the old pick. That's like their 2010 pick.
That's your pick. I think they'll sell this at Costco.
I have used this for, I feel like, maybe 20 years.
I think that was the old pick.
Sometimes I use the 5 millimeter and I'm like, this pen needs to try harder. And I like the 7 millimeter.
The Jetstream pulled it off. I was
right.
Skeptical.
All right. Listen, I'm sometimes open to new ideas.
Nice.
Well, my recommendation is, you know, I continue to do my Dungeons and Dragons nonsense. And then I've been playing the Icewind Dale Rime of the Frost Maiden adventure, which is a gigantic book. And I went into the Reddit, and there's even a Reddit group for it. And I was browsing through it, and some people say, oh, we finally finished this 3 years later. And I can see how it would take a long time to work through it. But I've only been messing with it a little bit. And the first of 3 chapters is what they call, I never really understood what this means. They call it a sandbox adventure, which means it's not linear and you just run around and do stuff. Kind of like in Grand Theft Auto, sort of. And it's nice. It's fun. And related to that, I wrote up a post today about how I used Midjourney to make gigantic maps to use in Dungeons & Dragons, which you can find if you go to our show notes at softwaredefinedtalk.com/461. And then I feel like I recommended these people before, this YouTube channel called Flavor Trip, where there's these two people. This one guy's got like a glorious 80s mullet. It's just like so fantastic. And a little cop mustache to go with it. And they just they seem to travel around and have really good multi-camera film of them hanging out at really cool, and not cool, but relaxing places. And the one I saw tonight was in Portugal, and they just set up in front on a balcony. They grill some stuff, and they play like some house music, which I don't like house music because it's got that beat to it, which I'm just like, yeah, I'm just like, if you remove that, I would enjoy the music. I sound like my grandpa, but it's just like, I don't get why that's there, but that's fine. But it's so nice that I don't mind it so much. And they literally, they're just like dancing around, smiling, drinking champagne, grilling some meat. And that's it for like 2 hours on a YouTube stream. It's good stuff. So speaking of good stuff, you've just listened to another episode of Software Defined Talk. If you want to get the show notes, you can go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/461. We've got a great little Slack community. You can even see the unedited bonus material in our YouTube channel. You can go to from there. All sorts of stuff that Brandon does ends up editing out of the audio edition. that you can catch and enjoy, and comments from people. And with that, we'll see everyone next time. Bye bye.
Bye.
Did not realize how Slack inserts links. So here's what I learned. This is, so I did the Control K, and this is the first time I see it. It actually, when you do it, it actually says, it pops something up when it says Control K, and it says, trying to add a link, use Command V instead. So I think that is some incredible product management. It's like, we know you're here to try to add a link, so we could just give you a pop-up button, right? And make it work. But they've actually gone out of the way to say, you're doing it wrong. I mean, of course, everyone probably knows Control V is paste. So I guess they have really drawn a line, like, we're making it better. You just copy your link. And if, when you do the paste, if we see it's a link and you've actually highlighted text, we'll make the hyperlink for you. right? So this is the old, like, we know what you want to do, and we're going to make it better for you, even though, like, we're literally going to tell you and almost kind of lecture you about using Command-K here.
So I hope you took
it. I've ever seen this, like, Command-K actually telling me, like, no, I know what you want to do, but I'm not going to let you do it. This is a new level.
I hope you took at least a screenshot, if not a screencast of that, because I think that's one. Send that to Jacob Nielsen. And I feel like
something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that probably goes all the way up to Benioff. And he's just like, inserting a link with Control-K is unnatural. Aloha.